You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We continue now with journalist Bill Moyer's speech at the Take Back America conference held last month in the nation's capital.
No wonder that what troubled our progressive forebears was not only the miasma of poverty in their nostrils, but the sour stink of a political system for sale. The United States Senate was a millionaire's club. Money given to the political machines that control nominations could buy controlling influence in city halls, state houses, and even courtrooms. You could even stack the Supreme Court with money. Reforms and improvements ran into the immovable resistance of the almighty dollar. And what, progressives wondered, what would all this do to the principles of popular government? Because all of them, whatever party they subscribe to, and hear me, all of them, Republicans and Democrats, were inspired by the gospel of democracy. And inevitably, that swept them into the current of politics, whether as active office holders or persistent advocates. There are a lot of young people here tonight, and I just want to take a minute to give you a small but representative sampling of their ranks, because my time has come. The time of many people in this organization has come and gone, but your time is coming, and you are our hope. Listen. Jane Addams forsook the comforts of a middle-class college graduate's life to live in Hull House in the midst of a disease-ridden and crowded Chicago immigrant neighborhood and make it an educational and social center that would bring pride, health, and beauty into the lives of her poor neighbors. She was inspired, she wrote, by an almost passionate devotion to the ideals of democracy and to combating the prevailing notion of the day that the well-being of a privileged few might justly be built upon the ignorance and sacrifice of the many. Community and fellowship were the lessons she drew from her teachers, Jesus and Abraham Lincoln. But people simply helping one another, she discovered, couldn't move mountains of disadvantage. She learned that private beneficence wasn't enough. It would take more than soup kitchens and fundraising prayer meetings, more than faith-based initiative. Social arrangements, she wrote, can be transformed through our conscious and deliberate effort. Take note, not individual regeneration or the magic of the market, but conscious, collaborative, cooperative effort. Meet a couple of muckraking journalists. Jacob Riis lugged his heavy camera up and down the staircases of New York's disease-ridden, fire-trapped tenements to photograph the unspeakable crowding, the inadequate toilets, the starved and hollow-eyed children, and the filth on the walls so thick that his crude flash equipment sometimes set it afire. Bound between hard covers with Riis's commentary, they showed comfortable New Yorkers how the other half lived. And they were powerful ammunition for reformers who eventually brought an end to tenement housing by state legislation, And Lincoln Steffens, college and graduate school educated, left his books to learn from the bottom up as a police beat reporter on New York streets. Then as a magazine reporter, he exposed the links between city bosses and businessmen that made it possible for buildings, builders, and factory owners to ignore safety. Steffens was out to slay that dragon that exalted the commercial spirit over the goals of patriotism and national prosperity. I am not a scientist, he wrote. I'm a journalist. I did not gather the facts and arrange them patiently for permanent preservation and laboratory analysis. My purpose was to see if the shameful facts spread out in all their shame would not burn through our civic shamelessness and set fire to the American spirit. If corrupt politics bred diseases, and I hear this from young people today who are deep into cynicism because they believe nothing can be changed and they'll pursue their private lives. If corrupt politics bred diseases that could be mortal to democracy, then good politics was the antidote. So was the discovery of Ray Baker, another journalistic progressive who started out with a detestation of election time catchwords and slogans. But he came to see, and I'm reading from his diary, politics could not be abolished or adjourned. It was in its essence the method by which communities worked out their common problems. It was one of the principal arts, politics, one of the principal arts of living peacefully in a crowded world. Compare that to Grover Norquist's latest declaration of war on the social contract. "We are trying," said Norquist last week, "to change the tones in the state capital and turn them toward bitter nastiness and partisanship." Bipartisanship, Norquist said, is another name for date rape. They have put us on warning. Anyone who doesn't take this seriously is going to be swept aside in the coming fight. There are more, too many more to call to the witness stand here tonight. But I want you to hear some of the things they had to say. There were educators and economists like John R. Commons or the sociologist Edward Rawls who believed that the function of social science wasn't simply to dissect society for non-judgmental analysis and academic promotion, but to help in finding solutions to social problems. It was Rawls who pointed out that morality in the modern world had a social dimension. In Sin and Society, written in 1907, long before Reinhold Niebuhr's Moral Man in an Immoral Society, he told readers that the sins blackening the face of our time were of a new variety and not yet recognized. The man who picks pockets with a railroad rebate, one might say a tax shelter in Bermuda, murders with an adulterant instead of a bludgeon, burglarizes with a rake-off instead of a jimmy, cheats with a company instead of a deck of cards, or scuttles his town instead of his ship, does not feel on his brow the brand of a malefactor. He goes to bed to sleep, the sleep of the just. And here are just two final bits of testimony from actual politicians. First, one of my heroes, Bran Whitlock, the mayor of Toledo. He first learned his politics as a beat reporter in Chicago, confirming my experience that there's nothing better than journalism to turn life into a continuing course in adult education. One of his lessons was that the alliance between the lobbyists and the lawyers of the great corporate interest on the one hand and the managers of both the great political parties on the other was a fact, the worst feature of which was that no one seemed to care. And then there's Tom Johnson, the progressive mayor of Cleveland in the early 1900s, a businessman converted to social activism. That's why I don't want to believe that in this class war, we've lost all the businessmen and all the rich people. We haven't. There's enormous possibility. You can see some of them in this room. There's enormous possibility for awakening the conscience of business people and rich people who understand that you don't have to feel guilt to love justice. Johnson's major battles. Johnson's major battles were to impose regulation or even municipal takeover on the private companies that provided public transportation and utilities. They crushed competitors. They overcharged customers. They secured franchises and licenses for a song, and they paid virtually nothing in taxes, all through their pocketbook control of lawmakers and judges. Johnson's argument for public ownership was simple: if you don't know them, they will own you. We've held that position in the campaign for public funding for public officials, that if anybody's going to own the politicians, it might as well be the people. When advised that businessmen... Let me be clear on something. These progressives weren't all saints. Their glory years coincided with the heyday of lynching and segregation, of empire and the big stick and the bold theft of the Panama Canal, of immigration restriction and ethnic stereotypes. Some of the progressives, as I said, were themselves businessmen only hoping to control an unruly marketplace by regulation. But by and large, they were conservative reformers. They aimed to preserve the balance between wealth and commonwealth. Their common enemy was unchecked privilege. Their common hope was a better democracy. And their common weapon was informed public opinion. In a few short years, the progressive spirit made possible the election not only of reform mayors and governors, but of national figures like Senator George Norris of Nebraska or Senator Robert La Follette of Wisconsin, and even that hard-to-classify political genius, Theodore Roosevelt. All three of them, Republicans, Here is the simplest laundry list of what was accomplished at the state and federal levels. Publicly regulated or owned transportation, sanitation, and utility systems. The partial restoration of competition in the marketplace through improved antitrust laws. Increased fairness in taxation. Expansion of public education and juvenile justice systems. Safer workplaces and guarantees of compensation to workers injured on the job. Oversight of the purity of water, medicines, and foods. Conservation of the national wilderness heritage against overdevelopment, and honest bidding on any public mining, lumbering, and ranching. Things that we now take for granted, or did, all provided not by the automatic workings of free enterprise, but by implementing the idea in the Declaration of Independence that the people have a right to government that promotes their safety and their happiness. That mighty progressive wave peaked in 1912, but these ideas that were unleashed by it forged politics in the 20th century. Like his cousin Teddy, Franklin Roosevelt argued that the real enemy of enlightened capitalism were the malefactors of great wealth, the economic royalists from whom it was necessary to save capitalism by reform and regulation. Progressive government became an embedded tradition of Democrats, the heart of FDR's New Deal, Harry Truman's Fair Deal, John F. Kennedy, and Lyndon Johnson. It had its final fling in the landslide of 1964, when LBJ, who was a son of the West Texas Hill Country, where the populist rebellion had been nurtured in the 1890s, won the endorsement for what he meant at the time to be the capstone of the arch of the New Deal. I had a modest role in that era. I shared in its exhilaration and its failures. We went too far too fast. We overreached at home and in Vietnam. We failed to examine some assumptions. We misjudged the rising discontents and the fierce backlash engendered by war, race, civil disturbance, violence, and crime. Democrats grew so proprietary in this town that a sterile political establishment grew so fat and complacent it couldn't recognize its own intellectual bankruptcy or see that a beltway was beginning to separate it from the rest of the country. The failure of Democratic politicians and public thinkers to respond to popular discontents, to the daily lives of workers, consumers, parents, and ordinary taxpayers, allowed the conservatives to convert public concern and hostility in a crusade to resurrect social Darwinism as a moral philosophy, multinational corporations as a governing class, and the theology of markets as a transcendental belief system. As a citizen, I don't like the consequences of this crusade, but you have to respect the conservatives for their successful strategy in gaining control of American public life. Their stated and open aim is to change how our country is governed, to strip from government all of its functions except those that reward their rich and privileged benefactors. They're quite candid about it, even about their mean spirit in accomplishing it. Their leading strategist in Washington, whom I mentioned a moment ago, Gorver Norquist, famously says that he wants to shrink the government down to the size that it could be drowned in a bathtub. More recently, in commenting on the fiscal crisis in the States and its effect on schools and poor people, Norquist said, "I hope one of them," meaning one of the states, "goes bankrupt." So much for compassionate conservatism. But at least Norquist says what he means and means what he says. The White House pursues the same homicidal dream without saying so. Instead of shrinking down the government, they're filling the bathtub with so much debt that it floods the house, waterlogs the economy, and washes away services that have lifted millions of Americans out of destitution for decades. And what happens once the public's property has been flooded? Privatize it and sell it at a discounted rate to the corporations. I actually disagree with Barney. I don't think this is the consequence of ignorance. I think this is deliberate, intentional, destruction of the United States way of governing. It is the most radical assault on the notion of one nation indivisible that has occurred in over 100 years. And I simply don't understand it, or the malice in which it is steeped. Many people are nostalgic for a golden age. These people seem sincerely to long for the Gilded Age. That I can grasp. But I can't explain the rage of the counter-revolutionaries to dismantle every last brick of the social contract. And I guess that at this advanced age, I simply have to accept the reality that the tension between haves and have-nots is built into the human psychology and into society itself. It's ever been with us. But to be frank, I'm just as puzzled as to why, with right-wing wrecking crews blasting away at social benefits once considered invulnerable, Democrats are fearful of being labeled class warriors. Why the Democrats are fearful of being labeled class warriors in a war the other side started and is winning. I truly don't get why conceding your opponent's premises and fighting on his turf isn't the surefire prescription for irrelevance and ultimately obsolescence. But I confess as well, my old habits still persist, but I'm not partisan. I confess as well that I don't know how to resolve the social issues that have driven wedges into liberal ranks, and I don't know how to reconfigure democratic politics to fit into an age of soundbites and policy dominated by a media oligopoly whose corporate journalists are neutered and whose right-wing apologists have no shame. What I do know is this, and I'm quitting. The social dislocations and meanness that galvanized the progressive movement in the 19th century are resurgent. But so is your presence tonight, your enthusiasm, the contagion of a celebration instead of a wake. So is the vision of justice, fairness, and equality, and that's a powerful combination if only there are people willing to fight for them. In addition to reading a lot of Page Smith these days, his several volumes of American history will stir the heart and mind. I've also been checking back with The American Commonwealth by James Bryce, published in 1895 at the height of the first Gilded Age. Americans, Bryce found, were hopeful and philanthropic. He saw the ills of that dark and unlovely age, but he went on to say, 100 times I have been disheartened by the facts I was stating. 100 times has the recollection of the abounding strength and vitality of the nation chased away those tremors. So what will it take to get back in the fight? Understanding the real interests and deep opinions the American people is the first thing. And what are they? That a Social Security card is not a private portfolio statement, but a membership state ticket in a society where we all contribute to a common treasury so that none need face the indignities of poverty and old age. That tax evasion is not a form of conserving investment capital, but a brazen abandonment of responsibility to America. That income inequality is not a sign of freedom of opportunity at work, because if it persists and grows, then unless you believe that some people are naturally born to ride and some to wear saddles, it's a sign that opportunity is less than equal. That self-interest is a great motivator for production and progress, but it is amoral, if not immoral, when not contained within the framework of community. That the rich have the right to buy all the cars they want, all the homes they want, all the vacations they want, all the gadgets and gizmos, but they do not have the right to buy more democracy than anyone else. That public services, when privatized, serve only those who can afford them and weaken the sense that we all rise and fall together as one nation, indivisible. That concentration in the production of goods may sometimes be useful and efficient, but monopoly over the dissemination of ideas is evil. That prosperity requires good wages and benefits for workers. And that our nation can no more survive as half a democracy and half an oligarchy than it could survive half slave and half free. And that keeping it from becoming all oligarchy is steady, heavy work, our work. Ideas have power, as long as they're not frozen into doctrine. But ideas need legs. Hear me. Hear me, young people. The 8-hour day, the minimum wage, the conservation of natural resources and the protection of our air, water, and land, women's rights and civil rights, free trade unions, Social Security, and a social service based on merit, all of these were launched as citizens' movements and won the endorsement of the political class only after long struggles and in the face of bitter opposition and sneering attacks by the Murdochs and DeLays, the Gingriches and Limbaughs of their day. Democracy doesn't work without citizen activism and participation, starting, as Regina said, at the community. Trickle-down politics don't work much better than trickle-down economics. Hear me. Hear me. Civilization happens because we don't leave things to other people. What's right and good doesn't come naturally. You have to stand up and argue and fight for it as if the cause depends on you. Allow yourself that conceit to believe that the flame of democracy will never go out as long as there's one candle in your hand. But 1,000 candles become a searchlight, 1,000 more a floodlight, and 1,000 more a mighty beacon in the sky. I know you have the passion, so go for it. Never mind the odds. Remember that the progressives faced worse 100-some-odd years ago. Karl Rove isn't tougher than Mark Hanna in his time. And 100 years from now, I will wager you, although I'm not like Bill Bennett, a betting man, 100 years from now, I will wager that some historian will be wondering how they let Norquist and company get away with it as long as they did. How they waged war almost unopposed on the infrastructure of social justice, on the arrangements that make life fair, on the mutual rights and responsibilities that offer opportunity, civil liberties, and a decent standard of living to the least among us. Democracy is not a lie. I first learned that from Henry Damaris Lord, that progressive journalist whose book, Wealth Against Commonwealth, laid open the Standard Oil Trust a century ago. Lord came to the conclusion that to regenerate the individual is a half-truth. The reorganization of the society, which he makes and which makes him and her, is the other half. The love of liberty, he said, became liberty in America by clothing itself in the complicated group of structures known as the government of the United States. And then he said, democracy is not a lie. There lives in the body of the commonality the unexhausted virtue and the ever-refreshing strength which can rise equal to any problems of progress. And he concluded by saying, as I do, in the hope of tapping some reserve of their power of self-help, this story is told to the people. Remember this story, the progressive story. It's your story. Go out now and pass it on.
Journalist Bill Moyer is speaking at the Take Back America conference held in the nation's capital last month. Thanks to Free Speech TV and Eddie Becker for production assistance with that piece.
Washington. So America voted on a president. No one could count on how the election went from Florida to Washington. Washington. So a new man in the White House with a familiar name said he had some fresh ideas, but it's worse now since he came from Texas to Washington. Guard to police the road from Baghdad to Washington. What is the thought process to take a human life? What would be the reason to think that this is right from heaven to Washington, from Jesus Christ to Washington?
To Washington by John Mellencamp. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Scott Gurian. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett of KPFA. Thanks to Pete Caracas, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Larry Binsky and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. That's 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send us your feedback to peacewatch@pacifica.org. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.